This is the Naked Genetics podcast with me, Kat Arney. Coming up later, our gene of the month is more than a little ancient. But first, regular listeners will remember that a couple of months ago, I went to the joint spring meeting of the Genetic Society, the British Society for Developmental Biology, and the British Society for Cell Biology, held at the University of Warwick. One strand of talks explored so-called newly tractable systems, new model organisms that geneticists are finally able to study for the first time, flippantly summarised as bees and trees. To get the buzz about our insect friends, I chatted to Paul Hurd from Queen Mary University of London.
So what fascinates me, I guess, are honeybees. They fascinate me for a number of reasons. They're important pollinators, they're important for maintaining genetic diversity in flowering plants, and plants, of course, are required for all animal life because they fix carbon from the atmosphere and produce carbohydrate. So they occupy a pretty crucial place in ecosystems. From a kind of genetic point of view, they're interesting because a bee genome, a bee larva, doesn't just have the capacity to become a bee, it can become three different types of bee. And the question is, how is it that one genome can become three different animals? What is it that enables that to happen?
So this is more complex than in humans we have males and females. This is much more complicated than that.
I think it probably is more complicated. So obviously in humans, we all come from a zygote, and that zygote has the potential to form 200 or so different cell types. For bees, that same zygote has the potential to form 200 different cell types, but wrapped up in three very different organisms. So I think it is more complicated, yes.
So introduce me to the different characters in the honeybee hive. Who do we have in there?
So top of the pile is queen bee. Queen bee is the largest insect in a hive. She's the reproductive female. She can lay fertilized or unfertilized eggs. If she lays an unfertilized egg, the resultant larvae becomes a male, which is also reproductive. If she lays a fertilized egg, which is what she tends to do most of, that larvae will grow and develop into a non-reproductive female worker bee. So two female bees in a hive, one can reproduce the queen, one can't reproduce the worker.
And what do we know about what's going on in terms of the genes, the control of the genes that are doing this sort of switch and controlling these different types of bees?
So this is what we're interested in looking at. Honeybee caste determination, whether you become a queen or a worker, is dependent on diet. So what the larvae eats within the first 3-4 days of it hatching actually determines what it will become as an adult. If the larvae eats royal jelly, a specialised substance, a nutritional substance produced ironically by the workers, the larvae develops into a queen. If the larvae is fed the boring, carbohydrate-rich nectar pollen, then she will become a worker.
This is a switch that's affecting the outcome, basically based on diet. That seems quite strange to determine something as important as, are you going to be able to reproduce in your life or not?
Absolutely. I mean, bees really are what they eat. There has never been a clearer example of an organism really is what it eats. And the reason why we're interested in this is because the two bees are genetically identical, but what they eat changes what they become, we think this is happening at an epigenetic level, the layer of information on top of the genes which controls genomic output.
So there's increasing interest in humans about how the environment, the things we do, the things we're exposed to, the things we eat, influence how our genes are turned on and off, this sort of layer of tags and switches. So what do we know about how that's happening in bees that's making this switch between queen or worker?
We don't really know. That's one of the things that we're looking at. But to some extent, the components of royal jelly do at least give the impression that it's a pretty good epigenetic diet. So there are things within that diet that we think will be directly affecting gene expression, the switching on and off of genes, and it's that that we're trying to tease apart.
There are some health food shops that will sell you royal jelly and stuff like that. I mean, people eat it and say, oh, it must be good for my health. That can actually be concerning if it's making that sort of switch.
I think royal jelly should definitely come with a health warning. I would certainly not eat it. I've seen how it can change bee development from one organism into another. So I would treat it with caution.
Here at the spring meeting, we've just heard a series of talks about people who are looking at other unusual insect systems where there are different almost varieties or castes of insects. Tell me about some of those.
So there are a number of Hymenoptera that have this caste-based system. The other obvious one are ants. Ants work in a slightly different way in that there's no nutritional difference. It's thought that it's pheromone chemical signaling that determines choice of caste in ants. Bumblebees, it also seems to be a chemical-based system rather than a nutritional-based system. And finally, termites. And as we saw in the talk today, nobody really knows the ecology of termite caste differentiation. So what thing they all have in common is that they're all eusocial. So eusocial insects have this caste determining system because of kin selection. They're all genetically related. And so the hive as a whole looks after the one reproductive queen for the sake of the whole colony.
So it's all these organisms, they're all genetically the same, but they're putting themselves into different roles and jobs to support the overall structure of that society.
Yeah, so it's a classic case of E.O. Wilson's kin selection theory, where because of the genetic relatedness of all the organisms within the hive, they act as one superorganism for the good of the one reproductive animal within that colony.
I love J.B.S. Haldane's quote that he'd be prepared to lay down his life for something like two brothers or eight cousins. I guess it's that on a grand scale.
Absolutely, on a kind of 50,000 scale.
What do we still really need to know? What are the really burning questions?
I think the really burning question is still a fundamental one, which is how can a genome, if a genome is the book of instructions, how is it that that book of instructions can be read and interpreted in multiple different ways in response to various environmental cues? And I think that's the fundamental question in honeybees. I think the other question in honeybees that's kind of related is what happens to honeybees when their food is contaminated, if you like, with pesticide, and how pesticides that are ingested by honeybees change their physiology and behavior. And I think that's also a big question in the field.
And this is such a big issue in the environmental world with the neonicotinoid pesticides and the concern that if we run out of bees, we run out of food.
Absolutely. So it's thought that with the current decline in honeybee colonies, then there will be, at some stage, the inability to supply humans with food. And so it's a crucial question. And a lot of great neonicotinoid work has been done out of the UK from Jerry Wright in Newcastle that showed, ironically, bees are actually addicted to neonicotinoid-treated plants because nobody ever thought that a neonicotinoid, which is an agonist of nicotine, may cause bees to become addicted to the pesticide. And so she showed in a great piece of work that bees will always feed on neonicotinoid-treated pollen versus non-neonicotinoid-treated pollen because the poor bees are addicted to nicotine.
And one final question. Your lab keeps honeybees. You work on honeybees. Do you get honey out of them?
We do get honey out of them. East London honey is the best honey. I can recommend any East London honey you see is definitely worth buying. Everybody has flowers in their window boxes, in their nicely manicured gardens. So in actual fact, city bees are probably the happiest bees in the UK.
Paul Hurd from Queen Mary University of London.